Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. John Bartlett, Senior Project Director for the Primary Care Initiative at the Carter Center's Mental Health Program. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at advances in chemical testing technology. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's no secret that the nation's kids are sedentary and overweight, and the problem isn't being remedied in many of the nation's elementary and middle schools where there is little or no structured physical education. The National Foundation on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition has partnered with other organizations to find tools that will improve the physical health of students in schools across America. There's a new phys ed partner in town. Enter a popular interactive video game, Dance Dance Revolution, a game that engages players in real physical activity with energetic music and visuals on a computer monitor to keep participants moving for sustained periods.
And they have a very innovative product where it's kids up and moving, and dance is one of the things that resonates with children. And Konami has really advanced two components here, using a gaming context in promoting more physical activity through either a physical education program or through recess time, or through those break periods where children can access this at school or other youth-serving organizations.
Rich Killingsworth is the foundation's former director and says their congressionally chartered mission was to create private sector partnerships that will enable all Americans, and especially American children, to lead healthier lives.
Just health promotion itself in general as a discipline is kind of recreating their focus. So we're looking at where children and others are spending their time. And when you think about how we spend our time during the day, 6 to 8 hours of our day is spent behind a screen, whether that's a computer screen or a TV screen. And it's the idea of using that moment, and for children, to create more activity and something that resonates with them. Gaming is a powerful tool. It's a social tool. And if we can build in ways for them to be active through that, it's going to be sustainable. It's going to resonate with them. They're going to be attracted to it and use it as part of their cultural way of connecting.
So they formed a partnership with DDR creators Khomeini to create Dance Dance Revolution Classroom Edition. The PC-run program is user-friendly, led by a teacher, and each kid has a dance pad that tracks their BMI, their calories burned, and their physical output during this session.
It gives them a baseline for where they are and then how they're improving. And that culturally is very different from where we were. Kids are more oriented to numbers now and how progress is important in their social network.
Killingsworth says that the pilot programs in a number of schools have been extremely promising. Kids are already familiar with the game, have fun engaging in it, and there's a competitive element as well that spurs the kids on. The partnership also includes the American Diabetes Association, the American Alliance for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance, Dance Dance Revolution Classroom Edition, a fun, familiar, fast-paced video game kids already love to play, being used in a simple school setting to significantly increase daily movement and improve physical fitness. Now that's a bright idea. We're speaking today with Dr. John Bartlett, Senior Project Director for the Primary Care Initiative at the Carter Center's Mental Health Program. The Carter Center, founded 30 years ago by former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting peace and better health throughout the world. Dr. Bartlett coordinates the activities of the Primary Care Initiative, which seeks to facilitate better treatment of mental health and substance abuse in the primary care setting. Dr. Bartlett earned his medical medical degree from Yale and completed his psychiatry residency at UCLA Medical Center. He's a former vice president for Cigna Mental Health and is a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar. Dr. Bartlett, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks for the opportunity.
John, you've logged a few decades in the area of behavioral health and substance abuse, and it's estimated that 6 out of 10 Americans visiting a primary care provider are suffering from some sort of behavioral health or addiction issue, but that often those issues do not get recognized or adequately addressed in the primary care setting. So how much of an effect is this really having on people's health care in this country?
That's an excellent question, Mark, and frankly, one that gets right to the heart of what we see as the opportunity here. State-of-the-art epidemiological studies, I mean studies that look at the incidence and prevalence of diseases in a population, show that in any given year in this country, about 25% of the general population meet current diagnostic criteria for mental health or substance abuse issue. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all diagnosed. It certainly doesn't mean that they get treated, but they do meet diagnostic criteria. So we know that issues like depression and anxiety and addiction are widespread in the general population. We also know that these conditions are associated with high levels of both morbidity and disability. In fact, the World Health Organization Burden of Disease Studies shows that in the developed world, countries like the United States, Canada, Western Europe, depression is the leading cause of disability-adjusted life years. In other words, it carries the greatest burden of disease, far greater than something like heart disease. They're prevalent, they cause a lot of disability, a lot of morbidity, and most importantly, in the context of what's going on in this country right now with our tremendous budgetary and financial issues, there's a tremendous amount of expense associated with the co-occurrence of a chronic medical condition like heart disease or diabetes and depression or anxiety. There were estimates that were used in the debates around the Affordable Care Act that showed that up to 15 and even 20% of costs associated with chronic medical conditions could be directly related to comorbid mental illness and or substance abuse. If you throw in behavioral issues like lifestyle choices, smoking, lack of exercise, obesity, you start to see the scope of the issue. And in fact, current studies from major leading managed care companies show that about 6 in 10 patients who show up in a primary care doctor's have some behavioral component, either a condition like depression or anxiety, or a lifestyle problem as part of their presentation. So it's really a huge issue.
So John, tell us more about the primary care initiative itself at the Carter Center's mental health program, and how is this initiative moving us forward in ameliorating this problem of lack of access to mental health and addiction services? And let me add the word effective to that as well, lack of access to effective mental health and addiction services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, the focus of mental health and addiction policy has been on those most severely impacted, people with what's called severe and persistent mental illness, people who are, you know, addicted and need abstinence-based treatment, et cetera. And that has really been a tremendous focus for the last 30 years or so, and frankly, successful, because we had things like the institution of parity with the Mental Health and Addiction Parity Act. So tremendous victories there, but beginning with the release of David Satcher's, when he was the Surgeon General, he released a report on mental health in America in 1999, and that really started a growing recognition that there was a hidden crisis about accessing appropriate and effective mental health care. And when I say hidden, it occurred in people who were seeing doctors. Mm-hmm. They weren't seeing specialists. They were seeing primary care doctors or general medical doctors or medical specialists, whatever. So that report really highlighted this. Over the last decade, a number of studies and large demonstration projects have been conducted in this country that have shown that there is a large associated behavioral component to the presentation of many, many people. So depression, problem drinking or drugging, an unhealthy lifestyle choice, et cetera. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work has been done in the area of depression for obvious reasons. It's an important condition. It's one that we have treatments for, and treatments, frankly, that can be implemented in the primary care sector. Over 50% of the people who get treated for depression receive their treatment only in the primary care setting. Under routine approaches to these patients, only 30% show clinically significant improvement. Yet at the same time, for many of the past several years, antidepressant medications have been among the most widely prescribed classes of medications in the country. In 2005, in fact, they were the most widely prescribed class of medications. So what we have is we have a tremendous amount of time, energy, money going into the treatment of a condition like depression, and yet only a very low clinically significant response rate. So we're literally wasting tens of millions of dollars on not ineffective treatments, but ineffective courses of treatment. Mm-hmm. The medications have all gone through FDA review, but it's how they're being prescribed, how they're being followed. That is not going on in the primary care setting, not because primary care doctors are bad people. They're busy people. The average primary care visit lasts somewhere between 12 and 15 minutes. In that 12 to 15 minutes, a primary care doctor has to deal with three or four chronic medical issues, as well as a depression, anxiety, problem drinking, drugging, etc. So diabetes, congestive heart failure, arthritis, depression, etc. Depression sort of comes usually at the end. How's your sleep? Are you feeling better? Yes, etc. It's not adequate follow-up. And so, in fact, what we find is that response rates are not very good in the primary care setting. They're not all that good in the specialty care setting either, frankly. We really have a lot of work to do in terms of becoming more scientific about how we not just prescribe medications, but more importantly, how we follow treatment response.
John, you've got a great perch at the Carter Center, where you work with multiple partners in the pursuit of eradicating disease globally, but also providing better health care to Americans here at home. And I wonder if the conversation that you were just having now came out of the work that you had done at the Health Education Summit, where you jointly held this summit with the American College of Physicians and issued a paper, The Five Prescriptions for Ensuring the Future of Primary Care. So perhaps you were telling us part of that already, or if not, can you tell us about both the collaboration with the College of Physicians and what are you prescribing for the primary care practices?
Well, we have a very active and collaborative relationship with the primary care specialties, the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Physicians, et cetera. And actually, what I was talking about did lead to the Health Education Summit, Mark. It actually came out of an earlier summit meeting that we had here mm-hmm. called the Medical Home Summit, which happened in the summer of 2009. And that summit, we brought together about 50 people from the fields of primary care, behavioral care. This was all going on in the context of the discussions around health reform in the country at that point in time. So the question that we tried to address at the Medical Home Summit was, could the patient-centered medical home be used as a platform to scale up evidence-based approaches to integrated care? Out of that meeting came a couple of recommendations. One was that we work closely with the accrediting organizations like the National Committee on Quality Assurance to make sure that whatever standards were developed for accrediting patient-centered medical homes focused very clearly and explicitly on the importance of recognizing, screening, and addressing behavioral health issues in the primary care. And that was an effort that was successful with the release of the new revised standards for the patient-centered medical home about a year and a half ago. The other thing that was recommendation that came out of the Medical Home Summit was that we do something to address the education of health professions. That led to the Health Education Summit, which we co-sponsored with the American College of Physicians. At that summit, we tried to address the question of, are we training the health profession students of today to work efficiently and effectively in the health delivery system of tomorrow?
Well, John, that's, I think, right on target, and certainly you've spoken about training, and we look at this pipeline. Where is this workforce coming from? And as we look at the early implementation of elements of the Affordable Care Act and then more of it coming with the insurance expansions and Medicaid expansion in January 2014, how's the Affordable Care Act speaking to the issue of workforce size and development, education, and training?
In the context of integrated care, Margaret, it's doing some things well. I mean, it certainly has made a commitment to increase the size and impact of the primary care workforce in this country. Okay, so there are provisions within the Affordable Care Act that increase reimbursement to primary care physicians, which have traditionally been underfunded, like psychiatrists and other mental health clinicians have traditionally been underfunded. There are increased training slots for primary care physicians, et cetera. In terms of promoting integrated care, it's exactly those initiatives that you just spoke about, the patient-centered medical home demonstration projects and the accountable care organization demonstration projects that really are advancing integrated care as well. I mean, it's my belief that when you start moving into an environment like an accountable care organization where a single entity is responsible for both the clinical and the financial results for a defined population of people, if you do not aggressively screen for and address behavioral health issues like depression and problem drinking, drugging, you'll never be able to meet the financial or clinical goals of the ACO. So that's really the next generation of hope for integrated care in a way. In terms of producing a workforce that is trained to work in that direction, there's still a lot that needs to be done, frankly. I mean, there is a great emphasis now on teaching team-based work to health profession students, but in terms of focusing that on the role of the behavioral specialist within the team and the recognition on the part of primary care providers that behavioral health issues are a major part of what they're going to be seeing in their primary care practice, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Bartlett, Senior Project Director for the Primary Care Initiative at the Carter Center's Mental Health Program, which is seeking to train primary care clinicians to better identify and treat behavioral health and addiction issues in the primary care setting. Now, the Carter Center relies a lot on the idea of teamwork to achieve its goals, and it's worked pretty well for the organization. But you say that teaching teamwork is an essential element of medical training of the future. Explain to us how you see teamwork model evolving in the emerging area of person-centered medicine.
I think that primary care is a team-based sport, frankly. Mm-hmm. People come in with incredibly complex presentations, and as I've already said, because of the current emphasis on efficiency in the primary care setting, where primary care providers basically are on sort of a treadmill and they're cranking out 12, 15-minute visits over and over again to keep the reimbursement rate up for the practice, it's extremely important that the care of individuals happen in a team-based environment. In 12 to 15 minutes, it's no single individual can address appropriately all of the issues that people bring into a primary care visit.
Yep.
Doesn't mean they have to do it all themselves, but it does mean that in a comprehensive, integrated, effective primary care environment, all of the services, not just the medical services, but the behavioral services, the care management services, the support services need to be provided. And you can only do that through a team-based mm-hmm. approach. Now, the interesting thing, you pointed out earlier that I spent a number of years as the Senior Vice President and Corporate Medical Director for Cigna Behavioral Healthcare. I worked in industry with companies like General Electric and Martin Marietta and IBM and the amount of money and resources that corporate America puts into training teams to be high-functioning teams is huge. It's literally tens of millions of dollars. We put no money into that in healthcare. When I graduated from my internship, I was a medical intern at Jefferson University in Philadelphia. I got in my car. I drove to California, where 2 weeks later, I was the leader of a treatment team mm-hmm. at UCLA. I knew nothing more about psychiatry than I had 2 weeks ago when I was a medical intern, but I was the team leader. So we don't do a very good job of training people, and there are a whole set of skills and approaches that you can use to train people to be more effective team members. We need to pay attention to that.
I want to maybe move one degree away from what we think of as the classic primary care office and think about innovation, maybe one step removed, still within what we would think of as general domains of primary care, and ask you to comment on your work in this area, your thinking about how it contributes. And I'm thinking specifically of things like school-based health centers.
Universal screening for behavioral health issues are extremely important. One of the interesting things that we're doing here is that we've actually sort of moved the concept of integration beyond the context of integrating primary care and behavioral care. We're actually moving into integrating the medical and behavioral delivery system into the greater community. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm involved now is working with faith-based communities around the country to move behavioral health screening out of the healthcare environment into the faith-based environment. Great. Through pastoral screening and counseling, frankly. A couple of years ago, we co-facilitated a meeting with the National Center for Primary Care at Morehouse School of Medicine, where we brought together a group of individuals, we call them early adopters, from organizations such as yours, who have moved pretty far down the path towards being patient-centered medical homes. And then we invited a whole bunch of other people who were interested but had not made that commitment yet. And it was funny, all the people who would sit there and say, like, well, we're really interested in this, but we need to get paid for it. Mm-hmm. All the early adopters said, don't worry about that. It will more than pay for itself. It's the right thing to do. Interestingly enough, when you start moving this into the pastoral environment, they just focus on that it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so we're very interested in using this mobilization of the faith-based community. We could just as easily look at mobilizing the business community, as you talked about. Mm-hmm. It's using these other channels to bring screening and early interventions out into the community in an effort to improve overall community health that we're getting very interested in at this point.
We've been speaking today with Dr. John Bartlett, Senior Project Director for the Primary Care Initiative at the Carter Center's Mental Health Program. The Carter Center, founded 30 years ago by former President Jimmy Carter and First Lady Rosalynn Carter. You can learn more about all of the exciting work that's being done at the center by going to cartercenter.org. Dr. Bartlett, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark and Margaret.
I'm Mariano here with this tech report. Imagine if this cycling world had had a drug testing tool that was so cheap yet so accurate it could detect even microscopic amounts of drugs present in a person with results almost instantly and on sight. Then maybe we would have been spared
CBS
this.
CBS News has confirmed that Lance Armstrong now admits using performance-enhancing drugs after denying it for more than a decade.
On Lance Armstrong, the global governing body of cycling has
researchers at the University of Manchester in England have developed just such a tool. It's the place where scientists first identified the material graphene that would earn them the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2010. Dr. Sasha Grigorenko is heading a project using this graphene in a new kind of detection system called graphene plasmonics. First, for a little background, what is graphene exactly?
So basically, if you look at graphite, it consists of layers of carbon atoms. And if you take just one layer from graphite and put it in a substrate, it would be a graphene.
So this graphene plasmonics has a lot of power, not just in drug testing, but security in airports as well.
I would say that at least in airports, you can look for explosives. Permanent detection of explosives would be nice. So if somebody's trying to smuggle some amount of TNT or like permanent detection of marijuana would be nice instead of dogs, you can have something which would detect that stuff.
Basically, how it works is a sheath of graphene is coated by a substance that allows for precise optics to zero in on the presence of even a single molecule of something they might be looking for. So drug testing on the spot or forensics at crime scenes. Currently, criminal investigators have to rely on old fluorescent captures and long waits for lab results.
It takes a lot of time to put all the proper fluorescent agents on the top of the material you're going to study and then look in the microscope, or our procedure, which makes this thing quicker and cheaper.
And Dr. Grigorenko says what's amazing about graphene is it's not only highly efficient, but far cheaper than the currently popular silicon, so ubiquitous now in the world of computer chips. While we wait to see if graphene does indeed revolutionize the computer chip industry, it could put a big crimp in sports doping.
Knowing that you can be checked like everywhere with like just small amount of droplets of the blood, it should stop many people of trying to cheat.
Remember that line in the movie The Graduate? Plastics? Well, kids, the buzzword for 2013 appears to be graphene. You can learn more about this exciting development by Googling graphene plasmonics at the University of Manchester in England. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.